I'd like to take our Bibles this morning and this time turn to Isaiah 51, and let's read this passage again rather than me just quoting it to you once again. This has, of course, been the text passage that I have chosen to use for this series of messages that I'm currently preaching. Isaiah 51 and verses 1 and 2, and if by now you can quote it, just quote it with me. You won't have to go back and read it. We're getting close to knowing it by heart, I'm sure. Isaiah 51, verse 1 and 2, where it says, "Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek Yahweh. Look unto the rock whence you are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence you are digged. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him." And I might point out again, it says, "Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness." If you're a seeker of righteousness, this is part of God's instructions found in His Word that He says, look to Abraham and look to Sarah, to the forefathers of your people who bore you. There's something in that that God says is important. There tends to be, in this day and age, a putting down of looking at all to your past or to the history of your people. At least when it comes to our people. That's not necessarily true. You know, there's movies like Roots and things like that for the races of other people. But they don't want us to look. And I've already dealt with that in previous messages. But according to God, He says there's righteousness in looking. As long as we look with the right perception, we understand from the right perception what it means to look back at those people. It's nothing, as Herschel pointed out in the Sunday school class in the previous hour. It's certainly nothing to look at ourselves in some magnificent way from because of who we are. If anything, it puts us, it really should set us back and humble us to know who we are and then also know what we've done in the past. The title of this series is The Basics of Christian Identity. This will be part 9. I thought possibly, I'd get it done in 10 messages. Not likely. Maybe 12, if I'm going to end on an even number. But I'm trying to set this going up very slowly, taking nothing for granted, trying to take it a step at a time, so that, and there will be some things, but so that nothing escapes through the cracks, and so that the questions that I know will be raised by so many people when some of this is presented will be answered as we go along. Anyway, this is part 9 of Basics of Christian Identity. Once again, to this point in this series, as I at least in part pointed out in the previous message, we've been able to determine that not everyone living today are Adamites. That those today primarily claiming to be Shemites or Semites are not. That not all Shemites are Israelites, that not all Israelites are Judahites or Jews. And in the last message, we just started to explore the possibility that not all Gentiles are non-Israelites. Now, before delving into that more, I want to return some 2,800 years from this point in history, some 2,800 years to Yahweh's divorce of the house of Israel. I pointed out in the previous message that just as Yahweh's marriage to Israel had a major impact on Israel's future, well, let me assure you that so did Yahweh's divorce of the house of Israel. As I pointed out, nobody can be married and it not impact their life in a major way. Right, married people? Unmarried people, you'll find it out if you're blessed to be married. But let me also tell you, nobody can go through a divorce and maybe even with a greater impact upon their future than even their marriage, can go through it without an impact in some way upon their lives and their future. And think about it, even more so if you were married to Yahweh and then divorced by Yahweh at a later time. I also pointed out that in the Old Testament prophecies that the terms Israel, Ephraim, the primary tribe of the house of Israel, and Samaria, the capital city, that in prophecy those were terms that for the most part were interchangeable in the prophecy. If it was speaking of Israel, not in all cases, because Israel sometimes, depending on the context, referred to just Judah as well, but primarily or most often, when you saw Israel or Ephraim or Samaria, those terms were interchangeable in those prophecies being used for the house of Israel, at least for a while, for approximately 500 years. But what happened then to change all of that is the question. Why for only 500 years? If the house of Judah was over here in Judah, Jerusalem, and Jews or Judahites all referred to were interchangeable terms in prophecy for them, why would all of a sudden it change for Israel that Israel, Ephraim, and Samaria were interchangeable terms for them? Why, after 500 years of interchangeable use there in the Scriptures and specifically in the prophecies, why would all of a sudden that change? Well, because for her apostasy, for her harlotry, for all of her adulteries, the house of Israel was divorced by Yahweh her God. Or, if you prefer, Yahweh her husband. Do you recall in one of the earlier messages in this series how I pointed out the significance of names and what they mean or what they might imply in the Scriptures? Well, who can tell me what the name Israel means? Somebody out here should know by now. It's not a good thing we sometimes go over things more than once. It means the term Israel. Think about the term El. The term or the name Israel means ruling with El. El being short for Elohim, thus ruling with Elohim. Elohim being the Hebrew term for our word or our understanding of the word God. Or ruling with God. That's what Israel meant. That's why she was given the name, because God, in outside of the confines of time and looking forward to what was yet to take place after he renamed Jacob Israel, there was a purpose in that. He didn't do anything just because for no purpose or no reason at all. There was always a purpose, always a reason, sometimes so far lasting that it's beyond the imagination or the comprehension of man. But when he renamed Jacob Israel, he was looking outside the confines of time to a future time when these people who would be known by that name would rule with him, with Elohim. And thus they were called ruling with God, or Israel, ruling with El. Now, when did Israel begin ruling with El, or with Elohim, or with God? When did it happen? Well, ruling implies a ruler, does it not? Most of these are not trick questions. I'm not going to let you know when we get to one. But it does, certainly. Ruling implies that there's got to be a ruler. And what's another name for a ruler? Easy question. What? A king. A king. And it was Yahweh who was and is king. Was he not and is he not? He is king. King forever. And if he is king, then listen, think about this. Then if he is king, then Israel, in ruling with him, as the name implies, would not only have to be his wife, but would also have to be his queen as well. And in order to rule as king and queen, they must have had a kingdom to rule, right? Now, I hope you're following with me in all of that. So let me ask you again, when did Israel begin ruling with God. When Yahweh married her. That's right. When Yahweh married her. Now, why would I say that? Well, turn with me. We're going to go back to Exodus chapter 19. Been there quite a few times, but let's go back one more time here. Exodus chapter 19. And reading verses 5 and 6 again. Again, the context. Yahweh has chosen Moses to be his emissary, to send him with a proposition to Israel, a marriage proposition. And listen closely again to Exodus 19, verse 5 and 6. In verse 5 it says, "Now therefore, if you will obey my voice," God speaking through Moses to Israel, "now therefore, if ye, Israel, will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant," excuse me, "then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me," or a special treasure, "unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine." Verse 6, "And you shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel." Now, that is the very, as I pointed out to you previously, that is the very first time in God's holy word that the word kingdom appears in the Bible in relation to God's kingdom. The very first time. And I'll tell you something, there's something too. The very first time and the very last time that you find something used in the Scriptures. I don't know if you've ever looked at that, but so often that's the case. The first time is significant, and often it ties in some fashion with the last time that things are used as well. There's significance in the fact that this is the very first time that the kingdom, that the word kingdom is ever used in regards to God's kingdom. God said, "I will make you a kingdom." When? It came into existence when with his marriage to Israel. And thus, from that point on, the 12 tribes, listen to me, the 12 tribes had the legal right to wear and use the name Israel, ruling with El. Right? Wrong. I told you. I kind of warned you there was going to be one in there. Wrong. She had the legal right to wear that name only as long as she remained married to Yahweh. You following with me now? You see, I said from that point on the 12 tribes had the right. No, she did not. She only had the right to wear that name as long as she remained married to Israel. Once she was divorced, she no longer ruled with El. You think God, after divorcing Israel, would allow him to still rule the kingdom with him? Absolutely not. And thus no longer had the right to wear that name, Israel. It was her married name. It was her married name. Now again, God had to allow them to carry the name for a while, but it was looking to this point in Exodus 19 when he would marry her. Again, being outside the confines of time, he was looking to that point in which he would have the legal right to wear that name. It was her married name, and she had claim to it so long as she remained married to Yahweh Elohim, or Elohim Yahweh, God Israel, or Yahweh God, however you want to say it. Just as it is with my wife and your wife, Linda has the right to wear her married name of Weiland only so long as she remains married to Ted Weiland. And the same for your wife as well. Does all this make sense? Are you following me with me in it? Because we're kind of just building it and working our way to a very important point here. In other words, since Yahweh divorced the house of Israel, she then, as a consequence of all this, she then must have undergone another name change. Because she couldn't be Israel anymore. You know, through the process of time. She could no longer be called by the name of Israel, so she must have come over the period of time, a period of time, she must have come to be called something else. Lights. Should have lights going on here. Concerning this, listen to a very revealing statement from the 1905 Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 12, page 249, under the heading Tribes Lost Ten, dealing with the lost 10 tribes of Israel as they identify or as being lost, or what we know to be the house of Israel. Here's what it says. Listen to this. It says, quote, if the 10 tribes, of course, of the house of Israel, if the 10 tribes have disappeared, and they know that's become, even they understood that that's become a prominent doctrine, that they've disappeared, amalgamated, become extinct is what they're talking about. They say, if the 10 tribes have disappeared, the literal fulfillment of the prophecies would be impossible. Boy, I wish that most of our pastors today understood what these people understood in this statement. Because most of our pastors today are saying there's no longer a physical Israel, or at least the 10 tribes are gone, amalgamated, extinct. But if that's the case, just like they said, then the literal fulfillment of the prophecies to Israel will never be fulfilled, and God thus would be a liar. And so they again said, if the tribes have disappeared, the literal fulfillment of the prophecies would be impossible. If they have not disappeared, obviously they must exist under a different name. End of that quote. Jewish Encyclopedia. As a consequence of the divorce, they are no longer known as Israel and are instead known as or by something else. So, by what name or names do you suppose she was, subsequent to the divorce, known as? That's just something for you to think about for the time being. We'll get back to that a little bit later in this message and continuing into the next. In the last message, we read about Yahweh's divorce of the house of Israel from Jeremiah chapter 3. In today's message, I'd like to do the same, only this time from the prophet Hosea's account of the same divorce. So if you'd turn with me to Hosea. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and Hosea. Hosea chapter 1, and we'll begin with verse 2. Or let's just begin with verse 1. It's the beginning. Let's just start there. Hosea chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. It says, the word of Yahweh that came unto Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Of course, it's setting the time frame for Hosea's prophecy. Verse 2, the beginning of the word of Yahweh by Hosea. And Yahweh said to Hosea, go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom departing from Yahweh. Now, whether we understand it or not, God did. He chose Hosea to do something that, for the most part, would be absolutely an atrocity to anyone else. But he did it, obviously, for a reason, and maybe for two reasons. One, first of all, that what was going to take place in Hosea's own life with this wife of harlotry and the children that she would bear for him, and even in the names that he named her, it was all a picture of what Israel and her relationship with God had become. Also, maybe it was also, as I pointed out in my series, my expository series in the book of Hosea, that maybe he wanted so that it could come out with the depth of feeling that he said, listen, Hosea, I want to put you through it so that you'll not just write it, but you'll write it in a way that it'll have an impact with feeling and that will impress people like it would never be impressed unless you had lived what I've gone through myself. But anyway, we need to establish that for those who maybe aren't familiar, that God did it for a reason. Whatever reason it was, God did it for a reason. I may not have figured out the reason, but he did it for a reason, and it was a picture. It was certainly as a picture of what Yahweh and his relationship with Israel had been and was. Continuing, verse 3, so he went and took, he being Hosea, so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. Verse 4, and Yahweh said unto him, call his name Jezreel. And again, watch, because those names and what they meant were again all reflective of God's relationship with Israel, what it had been and what it was to be, what it was coming to be. And Yahweh said unto him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu. And listen to this last part closely. For it says, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And we're going to see he's not talking about all 12 tribes here, because he makes a distinction a little bit later on in this first chapter between the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So the context very clearly shows us that the house of Israel, that we're speaking of only the 10 northern tribes. But he says, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. Now, let me remind you that Yahweh's kingdom relationship with Israel, came into existence with his marriage to Israel. Thus, if the kingdom was being made to cease with the house of Israel, here in Hosea's prophecy, Hosea, or Yahweh, more particularly Yahweh through Hosea, must be talking about Yahweh's divorce of the house of Israel. Can you see that? Once again, since the kingdom came into existence with the marriage, the cessation of the kingdom with any part of Israel would be indicative of her divorce. Divorce isn't used in this particular chapter of Hosea. I don't know that the word is used throughout. I don't think it's used in Hosea at all. But there's no question that if the kingdom came into existence with the marriage, the cessation of the kingdom must mean the divorce. Talking about the same thing that Jeremiah did in Jeremiah 3. Now, or let's continue. Verse 5, and it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she, that is Gomer, conceived again and bare a daughter. And God said unto him, Hosea, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah. Again, notice, the house of Israel he's dealing with in one fashion, and the house of Judah in another. And will save them. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and will save them by Yahweh their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call him Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Now you read, I don't know if any of you went this previous week, I hope you did, and went back and read Hosea for yourself, especially these first two chapters where we're primarily primarily dealing with. But you, at least right now, you read the context right along with me. So let me ask you, who was Yahweh directing that statement at? Was it to non-Israelites or Israelites with whom Yahweh through Hosea said, for ye are not my people? Come on. Israelites. There's just no question about that. It was directed to Israelites, specifically in this case to the house, those descended from the house of Israel. Now, why would he say that to them? Why would he say to them, for ye are no longer my people, for you are not my people? Well, because they had become his people, that is, his wife, when he had married them. And now that he was going to divorce them, they, that is, the descendants of the house of Israel, would no longer be his people or his wife. It's that simple. And you say, well, that is simple. Why are you emphasizing that? Well, because when we finally take this back to the New Testament, where some of these verses are quoted, because so many people have come from only a new covenant perspective, and it's been a false new covenant perspective on top of it, and have failed to go back to Hosea and see what the prophecy was about and applied it to the wrong people. We've got to just break it down and really look at it, and we can come to the conclusion that it's so simple in reading the context that those statements, specifically that one statement and, of course, all the rest, were directed in this passage to the house of Israel. Now, think about this. If, as a consequence of Yahweh divorcing them, the house of Israel was no longer His people, no longer to rule with El, or no longer to be known as Israel, what do you think that did to her, for her identity? What do you think it did for her identity? Well, I don't know about you, but I would think that one could safely say, or accurately say, that the house of Israel suffered a loss of identity. Wouldn't you? I think she had a loss of identity. And I'm not the only one who has described it as that. In 1914, Walter Hutchinson, in Volume 2 on page 530 of Hutchinson's History of the Nations, wrote this, quote, in consequence of Jeroboam king over which house? Testing you guys. Okay, we're going to go back to part one and we're going to start over. King of the house of Israel. I know it's tough. Jeroboam and Rehoboam, it's tough to keep those straight. But Jeroboam, king over the house of Israel, in consequence of Jeroboam's ambition, aided by the weakness of Solomon's successor, Rehoboam, and you got to get this one right, king of which house? The house of Judah. And aided by the weakness of Solomon's successor, Rehoboam, at about the year 937 B.C., there were formed the rival and often hostile kingdoms of Judah and Israel, the latter of which lost its identity by the capture of Samaria. End of that quote, which was by the hands of the Assyrians. When God divorced her, He allowed the Assyrians to come in capture them and dispossess them of the land and disperse them. And as a result, according to Hutchinson, he says as well, they lost their identity. Not only that, but in 1994, much later time, Yair Davidi, who is a Jew, in his book, The Tribes, on page 6, stated this. He says, quote, the lost 10 tribes were destined to lose their identity. Also on the back cover of the same book, he says, most of the ancient Israelites were exiled and lost their identity. End of that quote. Again, if only some of our pastors today could see as clearly as sometimes what some of these Jews can see. To say that the house of Israel, who was divorced by God and who were no longer His people or known as Israel, lost her identity is not some far-fetched idea, like some would like to make it today. It just stands to reason. If they were no longer His people, no longer to be known as Israel, all of a sudden losing. I mean, it'd be like all of a sudden, you know, here we are as Americans, and all of a sudden that identity is robbed from us. It's like getting hit on the head and getting a concussion and, what's the term, amnesia. You know, now surely it took over a period of time for this to happen. It wasn't like a conk on the head, but over a period of time, because of this disbursement out amongst all these other nations at the hands of the Assyrians, they slowly lost their identity. And it is not some far-fetched idea like those who are opposed to this idea would like to make it. Hutchinson didn't think so, and neither did Yair Davidi in 1994. As a consequence of her divorcement, Yahweh Himself declared the following. In Hosea 2, verses 1 and 2, He says, say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and say to your sisters, Ruhama, not Lo Ami, or Lo Ruhama, which means not my people, and so forth, but instead just the opposite. He says, say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sisters, Ruhama, Plead with your mothers. Plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put her whoredoms out of her sight and her adultery from between her breasts. In verses 1 and 2 of chapter 2, again, God being so descriptive through Hosea, and you can imagine again, Hosea having lived through it, he knows what he's talking about. And he knows what God is talking about because he lived it himself. And he talks about her adulteries and her prostitution and her whoredoms and all that was involved with that. And he says this to her, Hosea saying it to Gomer in place of Yahweh saying it to Israel, and tells her to put these things away from you, pleading with her to repent of those adulteries and so forth. He pleads with her to turn them away, but of course at that particular time, which she would not do. Consequently, Yahweh went on to say in verse 6 the following. He says, therefore, because you will not repent, therefore I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she, Israel, house of Israel, shall not find her paths. He says, I'll hedge her so that she cannot find her paths. What is he talking about? Let me tell you, that is actually a fulfillment of another prophecy or promise by Yahweh as found in the Pentateuch in Deuteronomy chapter 31 and verse 21. First part of verse 21 says, and they have moved me, they again being Israel, they have moved me, Yahweh, to jealousy with that which is not God. They're committing adultery with other gods. They have provoked me to anger with their vanities. To which, so he's defining the situation, to which he responded in verse 26. He says, thus I said, I would, listen to this, I would scatter them into corners. I would make the remembrance of them to cease from among men. Now, if that's not a loss of identity, I don't know what is. They're still Israelites. I mean, they can't change their genes, but they've lost the identity of who they are. I wish I'd have found that passage for my book, in that section of my book, because that's really the best verse of all to describe as a part of Israel's identifying marks today, as far as the loss of identity. That's the best verse of all of them, and I didn't put it in the book. But that describes, she lost her identity so that nobody recognized her out there. Now think about that. If, and let me tell you, there's no if about it, but just for the sake of argument, if the house of Israel lost her identity, that is, if she no longer knew that she was Israel, and those same people, or at least the descendants of those same people, continued to exist today, and again I said there's no if about it, because not only it's not an if they exist today, it is since they exist today, because they must, according to what's found in Jeremiah 31, 35 through 37, and certainly other passages as well. Jeremiah 31, 35 through 37, where it says, thus says, saith Yahweh, who gives the sun for light by day, and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar, Yahweh of hosts is his name. If this fixed order, sun by day and the moon by night, if this fixed order departs from before me, declares Yahweh, then the offspring of Israel shall also cease from being a nation before me forever. Thus saith Yahweh, if the heavens can be measured and the foundation of the earth searched out below, then I will cast off all the offspring of Israel for all that they have done, declares Yahweh. This total casting off, as some people say, he's already done. You know, there's no more Israel today. They've gone out of existence, according to some people. Well, maybe according to some people, but certainly not according to Yahweh, because the sun still rules by day and the moon still rules by night. And either his people still exist today and he still has some kind of relationship with them, or God, again, is once again a liar. Who's the liar? Well, my God doesn't lie. I don't know about yours. Now, back to that. So if, no, let's forget the if. So since the house of Israel lost her identity and no longer understood that she was Israel, and since those same people do exist today, then some nation or nations living today, and it would probably be nations, since there was at least 10 and really 12, because most of Judah was taken into Assyrian captivity as well. So some nation or nations today who do not know their Israel, since they lost their identity as Israelites, are in fact true Israel. Again, taking this very slowly and just trying to build one step at a time, and so that you can come to your own conclusions. And by the way, that's one, once again, one of the identifying marks of who Israel is today. They are someone as a whole, as a nation or nations of people. They are someone as a whole who are not claiming to be Israel, because they think in this loss of identity that they're non-Israelites. So, with that being true, the obvious question then becomes, well, who are they? There was a magician working one time in the past, a summer cruise ship. And I wish the Grimms would hear. I thought it was very apropos that I would think of this, since they just got back from a cruise ship. Although, as you'll see, they'll be thankful they weren't on this particular cruise ship. But anyway, a magician was working a cruise ship that had a pet parrot who almost always was spoiling the act, because he would say, "The card's in his pocket. The card's up his sleeve. Disappeared through a hole in his hat." Well, at one point, the cruise ship sank, and the magician and the parrot found themselves alone together on a raft. And for 4 days, the parrot just silently stared at the magician. But finally, on the fifth day, he said, all right. He said, "What'd you do with the cruise ship?" Well, our question today is, okay, God, what'd you do with Israel? Well, I don't want to answer that question too quickly again. And I know some people who don't like long series or wish I had taken care of this a long time ago. But I don't want to answer that question too quickly, because I prefer to take this, again, one logical step at a time, so that you can, I could just tell you, because I know, the Bible proves it, archaeology has proven it, and history has proven it. I know who they are. It's just totally inescapable. And I could tell you, and of course, again, most of you already know, or at least have an inkling of that. But there's a lot of people, again, who will be listening to these tapes who are brand new, and are going to be shared these tapes as an introduction to this all. And I don't want them to have to just hear me tell them. I want them to be able to come to the conclusion themselves by just looking at what the scriptures say and see themselves what the inescapable conclusion is. Now, if over time, so we're going to take this slowly again, if over time those people from the house of Israel lost their identity as Israelites, generically, we'll get into specifics later, but generically, they must have been considered non-Israelites by others, by both others and by themselves as well, right? I know you're real airy now. This one's okay. I mean, what other choice did they have? If they lost their identity as Israelites, they had to consider themselves, and others too, had to consider them as non-Israelites. Now, in Christendom today, what's another name for non-Israelites? Help me with this one. Gentiles. In the Bible, when people think of Israelites and non-Israelites, they think of Israelites and Gentiles. That's correct. Those Israelites, as a consequence of Yahweh divorcing them, just became Gentiles, not only to everybody else and to themselves, but to God as well. Hopefully you're still in Hosea. Go to Hosea chapter 8 and verse 8. Hosea 8 and verse 8, it says, listen to this, it says, Israel, this is a consequence of her divorce, a consequence of God using the Assyrian Empire to cast them away and disperse them. He says, what would only be natural, he says, Israel is swallowed up, now shall they be among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. They were scattered throughout all of these other non-Israelite Gentile nations. Turn to Hosea chapter 9 and verse 17. Hosea 9 and verse 17, he says, "My God will cast them, Israel, away because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. Or the same, really better translated nations here in the King James, but normally the word goy or goyim translated Gentiles. And then in Amos chapter 9 and verse 9 it says, For lo, I will command and I will sift the house of Israel among all the nations like as corn is sifted in a sieve. They're lost out there amongst the Gentiles. So once again, as a consequence of being divorced and then dispersed as a result of the Assyrian captivity, those Israelites were scattered amongst the non-Israelite nations or Gentiles, and then became Gentiles themselves, or not his people, which all of the Gentiles had been previously, but not his people in Yahweh's sight himself. They became Gentiles. They were known as Gentiles. They looked upon themselves as being Gentiles. The other nations looked upon them as being Gentiles. For the most part, they looked like just the other nations too, because most of the nations among whom they were dispersed were other Adamite nations, some of them other Abrahamic lineages, kissing cousins. They just weren't Israelites. They were just nations of other tribes, in most instances, at least initially, with where they were dispersed. And now don't miss the fact that also as a consequence of all of this, that from the house of Israel's divorce and banishment amongst the non-Israel Gentiles on, no longer can it be taken for granted that every time one comes across the word Gentile, that it refers to non-Israelite Gentiles. From that point on, that is no longer a foregone conclusion. Maybe before that time, although if you really look at the words ethnos in the Greek and goy in the Hebrew, it's really not a case anyway. But at least for those who think that, boy, all the time you find the word Gentile in the Bible, it always meant non-Israelites, I guarantee you, at least from the time of Israel's divorce and banishment amongst these nations, after her losing her identity, it can no longer be taken for granted that the word Gentiles means non-Israelite Gentiles. From that point on in history, there were no longer just non-Israelite Gentiles. There were both non-Israelite and Israelite Gentiles. Aha. Hopefully the lights again are going on. What was it that the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 9 that we looked at in the last message? And who was he quoting? Let's go there. Romans 9. How much time do I have, Herschel? Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9 and beginning with verse 22. Paul writes, and he says, "What if God, willing to show His wrath and to make His power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted for destruction, and that He might make known the riches of His glory on vessels of mercy, which He had afore prepared unto glory?" Verse 24, Even us whom He hath called, not of the Jews." We know that only refers to the house of Judah. "Not of the Judahites only, but also of the Gentiles." What Gentiles? Non-Israelite Gentiles? Israelite Gentiles? Or both? You see, we can't take it for granted anymore, can we? You can't just say, it's whatever I want it to be. We must let the context determine what Gentiles or nations is being referred to wherever we find it from the divorce of Israel on. Verses 24, so let's continue with Romans 9 and following. Romans 9, 24 again. "Even us whom He has also called of the Judahites only, but also of the Gentiles. As He says in Hosea, I will call them My people, which were not My people." Now that's just beyond where we stopped in Hosea. He says, "And He saith As he saith also in Hosea, I will call them my people which were not my people, and her beloved which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there they shall be called sons of the living God. Think about that. You know, these people who were no longer his people, who had become Gentiles, were people who at a later time would be called sons of the living God, which is another name for Christians. Another clue for the future. Now, once again, who was it that Yahweh declared all of what's quoted right there? And again, it's just immediately following. So we stopped in verse 9, that's verse 10, and then later in verse 2, he quotes there some from chapter 2, again about the same people. If you read the context, you of course know that. But once again, who was it that Yahweh declared all of this about in the book of Hosea? Who was it? Israelites. Israelites of the house of Israel, who had been his beloved and his people through matrimony, and who subsequently lost all of that, or became not his beloved people when divorced by Yahweh, their husband. Again, read the context. It's inescapable. I'll never forget that day in Aurora, Colorado, as I was having my quiet time early in the morning outside on the deck, one summer morning, because I'd seen some of this. And all I was reading Hosea 1 and 2, and it was like one of these again. Flatten your forehead. Like, man, Ted, how could you have been so blind? Because I immediately went right, my mind took me to Romans 9, and I knew Paul had quoted this. And up to that time, I had done like most, regrettably, the religious world has been doing, and saying it's non-Israelites. But Hosea's prophecy was not about non-Israelites. Yes, they hadn't been his beloved, and they hadn't been his people, but that's not the non-beloved and non-people that he's talking about. Those people are identified as Israel, whom he had divorced, who had once been those people. But who were also promised, as Paul is dealing with and as Hosea dealt with, that who are also promised to become his beloved once again at some time in the future when Yahweh remarried those same people. And yes, not only was Yahweh married once, not only was he divorced, but he also, the prophecies in several places, prophesy that he would also remarry. Not just anybody. You can't remarry anybody but whom you've been married to before. And that's why the covenants have all belonged or were between Yahweh and his people. Romans 9, verses 1 through 4. Jeremiah 31, 31 through 35. And Hebrews 8, 8 through 10. The covenants belong to Israel because it was a marriage covenant, a marriage contract between him and his wife. And so he didn't leave her just destitute, but he promised that he would remarry them as well. Or at least the descendants of those very same people. This prophecy by the prophet Hosea, quoted by the apostle Paul, let me tell you, is indeed about Gentiles. You can't get away from it, can you? He says, not only whom he called from amongst the Jews or Judahites, but also from among the Gentiles. That prophecy of Hosea, quoted by Paul, is indeed about Gentiles. Israelite Gentiles, or if you prefer, Gentilized Israelites. But let me assure you, it has absolutely nothing to do with non-Israelite Gentiles. There is no biblical justification whatsoever for any preacher or Christian to apply what Hosea and Paul declared to non-Israelite Gentiles. There is no Now, they'll justify it, but let me tell you, there's no biblical justification for it. If such preachers are correct, let me tell you, then God is a liar. Since if Hosea's prophecy is fulfilled in non-Israelites, like they like to do with it when they come to the New Covenant, then there is no fulfillment of the prophecy in literal Israel to whom the prophecy was made. And thus God would have to be a liar because he said it was to be fulfilled in Israel. So, in conclusion, Who did those divorced Israelites who lost their identity become? It goes through my mind right now again too. I'm thinking, you know, somebody's going to be thinking again, man, why is this so important? Well, hang in there. If you haven't figured it out yet, let me guarantee by the time we finish it up, this up. I mean, things like, let me just give you a little teaser for that too. Things like Bin Laden. Do you know that this whole thing that we're dealing with is one of the reasons, the misunderstanding that we have, this all applies to why Bin Laden bombed those two U.S. embassies? We'll talk about that. So don't get lost in the details in this. This is important for so many reasons I couldn't even begin to enumerate them. Well, who did they become? Who were these people who lost their identity because of their divorcement and banishment of people? Who did they become? Well, generically speaking, because that's as far as we've gotten, or in a broad sense, they became known as Gentiles. And so we'll have to leave it there because I think time is about out. For the coming messages, to narrow it down in order to determine what specific Gentile nations today are those Israelites who were divorced by Yahweh, but who were also promised by Yahweh that He would remarry them sometime in the future. And that, by the way, is another clue that you can also chew on between now and Basics of Christian Identity, Part 10. Let's stand and we'll again close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, thank You, praise You, and glorify You as our God, King, Judge, and Lawgiver, Father, as the husband of Israel, or Father for some, even yet the divorced, the one whom they were divorced from. Father, let it be that our people, Father, would be awakened. Lord, that they'd understand who they are, that they'd understand their obligations unto You and return in mass someday to know You as their God, King, Judge, and Lawgiver, and Husband once again. Bless this message again. Use it to Your glory. Use it, Father, not only to make people aware of who they are, but, Father, of also their desperate need of Yeshua the Christ and His blood-atoning sacrifice at Calvary. Father, make them aware not only of that, but also His resurrection and its importance on their lives and their relationship with You. We ask You to bless, we glorify You, Father, for doing so. It's in Yeshua the Christ that we again pray. Amen.